Welcome back, folks. This is the second hour. Thank you for joining us here in the member section. We are talking with Joaquin Flores from Center for Syncretic Studies and also from Open Revolt, New Resistance, Fort Rus. He's behind a lot of different projects or organizations, whatever you want to call it. And we had some really interesting topics that we brought up here in the first segment. And there's some I want to return to a little bit more to clarify, but there's also some we want to move on to a little bit later and talk more about, not the least Ukraine and Russia, and of course the general warfare tactics that are ongoing now, even with the aid of the media and whatnot. But I know you wanted to spend a little bit more time just kind of explaining to people what people can do individually in America. This is a really important topic, and I know you have more to say there, Joaquin, so please go ahead.
Yes. What people who are listening to this show will already be inclined to be more like leaders. And what people need to do is to take leadership in their lives and to understand that the views that they have are more popular than they realize. And when people understand and can get past this barrier of fear and can feel comfortable in social situations without, you know, being boring or dogmatic or coming out of the blue, but people need to raise these things in their communities with their friends, you know, around the water cooler at work, if you're whatever you do, you're, you know, in a car club or bowling team, or, you know, when you're gaming and you're, you know, chatting online while gaming, you know, bring these up and you'll be surprised how many people agree with you. You'll probably find that most of your criticisms of the powers that be are commonly held views. And once you do that, you'll feel so much less alienated and you will feel so much more in communion with the rest of the people, and you'll feel emboldened. And then from there, you'll be able to start talking to people about what you can do. So I think that people have to just get past this problem in psychology where they think that the mainstream view is the majority view. The mainstream view, meaning that that's what's put forward by the system through the media, through the editorial pages of the New York Times or LA Times, is not what most people think. And you will find that as soon as you start coming out of your shell and just talking to people normal.
Very good. I think if we remain silent, nothing is going to change, because I hate to say it, that for the longest time I believe that, you know, it doesn't matter, we can do this individually, it's more what we do as individuals and whatnot, and that's certainly true. If every individual did what we were supposed to do, I think we would be in a better world. But nonetheless, point being, it is a numbers game after all. We need to have the numbers there. People need to be on the same page, pulling in the same direction, otherwise we'll get nothing done.
That's right. And also people, you know, need to have a scope, a sense of what the goals are. Look, there will never be a time when 100% of the population is mobilized and politicized. Most people, for whatever reason, are more passive, and people just go with the flow. So all that's really needed is for about 3 to 5% of the people to believe something strongly. That 3% influences another sphere of about 10%. Once 10% of a population has a firm belief in something, the rest of the population, by and large, say the other 60, 70%, tends to passively follow that leading 10%. So this organic vanguard or this organic leadership comes simply from only 3 out of 100 people coming out of their shell.
So there's a kind of I always believed in natural leadership, that as you said before, there's a kind of a natural hierarchy in nature, and we have to learn to utilize that. That's another reason why I think egalitarianism and this kind of pathological egalitarianism has pushed itself onto people to decapacitate them, that no one stands out above another, when this obviously is not the truth in nature.
Yes, it's not the truth in nature, and the left in the U.S. and the right has, unfortunately, the whole history of the world, including American Revolution in 1776, and of course revolutions in the rest of the world, have been completely misunderstood in the U.S. And there's a sort of a very strange, almost anarchist criticism of power, which is pathological and leads us nowhere. And we can't say that we need to make change and simultaneously distrust people who are leaders. And we cannot, we should always question leaders, and we should always choose leaders who we identify with and who we agree with. But the fact that leaders exist is not a problem. This is a human thing, and there are solutions here.
Yeah, definitely. I also wanted to mention something as a brief comment to what you said before. I mean, I would love to live with, you know, people who are on the same or similar page as myself, or who we understood each other. We could focus on, you know, common goals and actually getting somewhere instead of, it feels to me, Joaquin, that society today has become about the most smallest, minute, mundane details. And we're spending all our time and resources, for example, in a country like Sweden, to get, you know, on a global level, a majority group, but who was a minority in Sweden, to get them to have more representation on the television, for, let's say, you know, ridiculous things like this.
Right,
you know, as we know, people become more and more isolated in a multicultural society where people don't recognize other people's customs. They do become atomized and hyper individualized to a certain extent. And I've seen this firsthand change, that shift take place in Sweden, and it's been one of those ways that we've been very easy to be controlled. And that's why I think this particular issue has been so beneficial to the elite. And that's why they're seeking to export these kinds of models to other parts of the world, where we are completely, isolated on certain geographical areas. That's why I think it is important to pull together and literally be with people who are like you in an area geographically, right? So location is very important here.
Yes, in the United States, there are, even though we critique liberalism and the direction that it's gone, especially neoliberalism, there are some real gems. For example, in the works of the utilitarians, Bentham, and also, of course, J.S. Mill, who talked about experiments in living. And if there are any liberal arguments against liberalism as neoliberalism, this sort of hegemonic, a unipolar world they're projecting, there are in the early liberals, in classical liberalism, there are some very, very good ideas which should allow for people to form intentional communities and that sometimes smaller is better, right? And so, you know, moving forward, one of the issues that we look at and that we are organizing around quite successfully is the fact that the propaganda around multiculturalism has been all about diversity. And we find this to be one of the most disturbing uses of Orwellian doublethink to have been forced upon us in the last few decades, because multiculturalism destroys diversity. And diversity is about, you can't have diversity without there being difference.
Yeah,
and it's almost tautological. I mean, it's, one cannot define diversity without there being difference.
it's such an obvious point that I guess the lie has been hiding right in front of our face, and we haven't been able to see it so clearly, right?
And there it is. And so, you know, we are the real champions of diversity. We want a world of these natural biospheres where you know, it's like we're so concerned about, you know, the spotted owl or, you know, a certain type of oak tree. But when it comes to human cultures, we have put under the specter of diversity this program of a melting pot, which is all about deracinating people and destroying these traditional cultures. And what's so fascinating is that the very same people who come sometimes often from the left, from Europe and the United States, from, say, suburbs or city life, who grew up in a cosmopolitan society, and they love to go to Thailand and eat Thai food and go to Buddhist temples, and they love to go to Egypt, to the pyramids, and, you know, learn something about Islam or get into Sufism or something. But what they don't understand is that the very same economic and social models that they are supporting inside of Europe and are supporting for the rest of the world are going to see that destroyed. And these very primal ecospheres of humanity are being destroyed. And so we are the ones who are saying that these need to be preserved. and that there, we are also saying that there is a European culture or a spectrum of European cultures, which is pre-capitalist, which is pre-modern, and which also reflect a true European culture, which existed prior to the Industrial Revolution.
Prior to Christianity, even.
And that these need to be looked at, and that Europeans, too, can also look at their own roots and can also look at their at the itinerary or the trajectory of their values. And they can approach a transvaluation of values, and they can look in the future for things which existed in the past, which may offer some solutions to the present problem.
Yeah, I mean, we have cultural diversity, and I think we need to seek political diversity, but then you do have the question of human biodiversity as well. And I mean, there are, of course, people on the left primarily who are refusing to recognize ethnic, even much less racial differences between people, for example. But one of my points has always been as well that people appreciate this beauty as they see it when this blends and all that, and when these, you know, people, you know, come together and whatnot. And I understand that there's a level of volunteer, you know, action in this too. It's not all that. There's people, you know, they're across boundaries. They fall in love. People in different parts of the world meet, and that's not what I'm talking about. I don't have anything against that, but I'm talking about the enforced and this kind of propaganda that exists within European and Western society right now as some kind of virtue to blending yourself out. And this is something you only will have once, and then that will be gone. If you take any culture in Europe, and if, let's say, that everyone got with a different ethnicity, then it would be beautiful for that one generation, and then it would be it.
Yes.
I think that there's no thought here in terms of what this means in the long term and the projection of this. And again, I know this is very politically incorrect for a lot of people, but frankly, I don't care about that anymore. This is too important.
Right.
And this imposed, you know, blending out of the races comes from us, again, from a top down. We have plenty of quotes from these elitists sitting here talking about these things as a measure to, as you said, deracinate people, make them all into one, you know?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, there has been, you know, digging in deep into this political discourse is, you know, I look at the mistakes that the right has made and that the left has made, but I'm also not a sectarian, and I don't view myself as alien to people and their experiences, right? So we identify with both. We don't, and while we can offer fraternal, you know, critiques, and we can try to build to redirect their efforts, there are concepts in the right and the left that need to be taken, and there are ideas that the right has been wrong about and the left has been right about. And for example, when leftists bemoan the destruction of native cultures, say with Native Americans in the U.S., or when leftists bemoan, for example, the U.S. war in Vietnam, which is really a nationalist struggle in Vietnam under communist wrapping, that this is because it is wrong to impose systems on other people. And so this is right. But in the same way that American leftists can bemoan the destruction of Native American cultures, they should not see themselves as not part of that process and also not deserving of having a culture of their own. Mm. And they should also understand that there are people all over the world who aren't drinking Coca-Cola, and you know, it's not a small world after all. The world is a very big place. It is full of mystery. There are things that you and I will never understand. There are customs and traditions that we will never wrap our heads around.
Yeah.
And to think that we can is very arrogant, and that rather we should simply work to build a world where all of these differences can exist in their own spheres. And like you said, of course, there's always people who travel, who fall in love. But it is a problem now that it is an economic policy, and you, as you have said so rightly, that they have made this a virtue. And exactly, it will only exist for one generation, and then it's all bled together.
Yeah.
And it's like this. It's like I throw a party, and I invite guests from like all over the world, and you know, people come in their native costumes and stuff like that. And when I have this party, it's a beautiful thing because you can interact with all these different people and hear different stories, and people are dancing differently, even they brought their different food to this big smorgasbord. But if I keep this party going for like 5 days, and this has like been proven, right? People start to dance the same way, you know, the food gets all made into one cuisine, and you know, people start dressing the same way. In other words, it's great to throw a party, but if the party doesn't end, actually what made the party a great party gets really stale. And yeah. And then it's, you know, so here we have now, we have a choice. It is not too late. We are standing at a crossroads, but it is not too late. We can still choose to embrace difference, and it is not a dangerous thing. And differences do not lead to war. You know, that is the thing that they have promoted ever since in Europe, since the end of World War II.
That's right.
Right. And that's not what caused these wars. And so I think that's something to focus on, that the problems in the world are not caused by differences, and the solution is not to erase them.
Well put. Very well put. There is a segregation that occurs naturally. Well, this is, you know, believed, if we follow the main line, even in terms of how these differences arose to begin with, they're separated by geography, and this happened naturally, and a love for those differences does not mean a hatred for the other or the others. It doesn't mean you can't, you know, do business with these people or travel or visit them or do whatever you want. It's fine. It's like it's taken to this extreme level now, where especially let's say pride for the expression of European culture, Western culture, that equals, you know, some kind of extremist hatred now. And of course, I think that this is mainly done as a psychological tool to try to prevent that resistance that actually is starting to occur now. I don't think that that's going to last in the long run, Joaquin, actually.
I think you're right. And I think that the way that people in Europe and the United States and Latin America have been traditionally, at least in the past century, been divided along secular and religious lines, and they've been divided along left and right wing ideologies. And we can see today that, for example, in the civil war and revolution happening in Ukraine, we can see elements and actually big clues about what's going to happen in the future in all spheres, not just in new political ideas and new syncretizations in the ideological sphere, but also we can observe how the media war is unfolding.
Let's talk more about that. This is a good time to go into that. Ukraine, the war with Russia, of course, I've seen this very much as a kind of a proxy war by Western and Zionist interest on a part of using Ukraine. And we've seen, of course, if we go back a few years, the different color revolutions, the different oligarchs trying to legitimize, a detachment from the old Russian satellite states, to having them turning against Russia for various different reasons. But let's talk a little bit more about that fourth generation warfare. You've been spending a lot of time looking at how the media even has been constructed these, fabricated realities of what is happening in the Ukraine.
Yeah, I've written about six major reports, 200 or 300 pages. It's quite a lot to get into. I can summarize it, of course. I've been doing the rounds and summarizing it. It's there are some fundamental features of it, of course. And the great thing about Ukraine is that it provides a perfect case study for everything that we've talked about today. Of course, on the ideological end, we can see how things like Operation Gladio used in Western Europe, where the post-Nazi, neo-Nazi groups were used to create a strategy of tension and to create a polarization of the working class and the middle class along these artificial left and right wing lines, and which then created the basis which in Europe, the cult of PC and political correctness and the new left was created out of this false polarization, where the left identified with this post-1968 counterculture, which is very different from the old hard left of the 1930s, and how there were really, prior to this in the 60s, there were really more of a close political spectrum between, of course, those who draw their political heritage on the populist radical right in Europe of the 20s and 30s, and the populist radical left in the same period. And so an artificial division was created, which then allowed for the people who were paid hitmen combined with paid agents who controlled hooligan gangs to engage in different types of acts of violence, sometimes petty, sometimes explosions, as we know, Operation Gladio, and how Operation Gladio kind of represents a fusion of both liberal and neo-Nazi working into a single coherent entity. And this is what was used now moving forward into Ukraine. So we saw a synthesis of liberalism and Nazism. There in neo-Nazism, and how this neo-Nazism is almost devoid of any of the socialism, which was part of National Socialism, and is really more like national liberalism. And what is strange about this is that this seems to be completely unrecognized by the people involved on the side that's being backed by NATO in Ukraine. And this has been accomplished through information war. Sorry, go ahead.
Do you think really that it's been, I mean, because when you saw some of those images there with, I forget it, his names now, but it was definitely Nuland. It was the newly elected prime minister, or if it was the president. And I know that he had a Jewish background, for example, but it was like they were kind of out and open of working with the Svoboda people and all that. And that was like, wow, what an unholy alliance. What was that about?
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, it's an unholy alliance of Zionists, which is a form of Jewish supremacism, and with the neo-Nazis, with the PC multiculturalist European Union line, and so this unholy alliance, it actually, when you understand the modern world or the postmodern world, this unholy alliance is actually something which exists also in the Middle East with Al-Qaeda and the alliance between the same European neoliberals and Israel and US and Al-Qaeda. And this is the same type of alliance that's being used in Ukraine, except instead of Al-Qaeda, you have, of course, the Svoboda and Pravi sector. And this is why I have written extensively explaining how the Pravi sector are the Wahhabis of the Ukrainian spring.
Huh, interesting. Now, so they've gone together here, and this is, do you think they've just kind of, both of these parties looked the other way to, in a belief that they think that they're going to be able to, you know, control the country, eventually take over, or is it something more sinister going on than this? They actually know what they're doing, and maybe even their ideological backgrounds aren't genuine, at least if we look at the nationalists there.
Yes, I think it's more the latter. They know what's going on. I mean, see, the thing that we have to understand is that, as we were talking about at the top of the hour prior, that there was a change happening in the nationalist movements in Europe, and how they were identifying with anti-colonial, anti-imperialist movements worldwide, and seeing that their right to be Europeans and the right to have a European culture was very similar to the right of Latin Americans and Africans and Asians to have those, respectively. And so what the Zionists actually did, working with the neoliberal and the liberal, meaning the mainstream establishment from Brussels in Europe, is they created a false pole of pro-Israel neo-Nazism. So they tried to. And it's quite strange that we see this in England with the English Defense League.
Yes.
In fact, anything called Defense League, and they may have to rebrand very soon if they aren't already. But anything called Defense League is a Zionist project, which has tried to pull together those elements of the neo-Nazi groups which have rejected the change in the nationalist movements in Europe towards. I hate to use the word. But inter-space nationalism, not to be confused with anti-nationalism or internationalism, but there is a new internationalism among the European nationalists, which has a broader perspective and has improved their scope of ideas and has fully understood the problem of capitalism as it's defined. I put capitalism in scare quotes meaning the corporate system and of banking. And so what happened is that in Europe, in Ukraine rather, from the very beginning, it was Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, which engaged in a very aggressive program, which was the doors to really develop this were flung wide open during the Perestroika Glasnost period. And from that, in the 90s, of course, Ukraine broke apart from the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union disbanded, and this Svoboda group was formed out of the Social National Socialist and Social Nationalist Forum, but their radio show was always called Svoboda Radio. And this was funded by, directly funded by Radio Free Europe and the National Endowment for Democracy and George Soros and, yeah, and the State Department. So, and these are the very same Zionists and pro-Zionists that have been involved in all of these same color revolutions and Arab Springs that we've seen in the last 7 years.
So the new internationalist groups that you mentioned here, they don't, I guess, then have the same classic view on who controls the very banking system that they oppose, despite that the, you know, bios of Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department points in another direction?
Right. It's quite interesting. So now you have this pole of attraction of trying to develop primarily what happened is in the early 90s, the neo-Nazi groups started to develop more work with each other and did begin to work together outside of control of Gladio and of U.S. State Department intrigues. And there were, what happened is that after 3 decades of working within this framework, there was there was groupings that moved out of that framework. And without sort of belaboring the details or complicating the narrative too much, we can generalize, Henrik, when we say that what basically happened is that these people started to describe themselves as third position. And it meant different things. Of course, historically in Spain, Spanish Civil War, third position kind of meant neither communism nor capitalism, but a third position. And historically, this was associated with fascism. But what happened in the early 90s, third position was actually kind of more like looking at socialism and workers' power and ideas associated with, say, Marxism or even the Soviet Union, and looking at how they actually further the interests of the concept of people who are nationalities or nations. And so without, again, getting into too much, in Italy, of course, there was Mao Spontex and Nazi Mao. And there was in Europe decades later in the early 90s, there was the third position. And so there then later there was a split in the third position. And there were groups that did try to reinsert the socialist platform and the idea of workers' power into the platform, kind of cutting against this Operation Gladio form of Spielbergian neo-Nazis.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And so, but you know, there's a lot of different kind of, you know, branches that have grown off this tree, but primarily, and for the purpose of discussion, we can condense these. And basically, the Pravi sector in Ukraine is still under the control of the framers of Operation Gladio. And they are aligned. They have pro-Israel positions. They are against the Palestinians because they have promoted, they have exploited the Islamophobia, which is, of course, a natural product of the economic policies that Europe has entertained and promoted, which have dislocated, you know, massive numbers of Turks, for example, into Germany and so forth. And so, but successfully, however, this has been countered, and a big difference has been made, of course, in understanding different types of Islam and different understandings of what the role of Islam in Europe is. And of course, you know, we oppose the Islamization of Europe, but at the same time, you know, we say that, you know, places where Islam has historically been rooted, this works quite well and is good for people who believe it, and they find a lot of meaning in their lives, and it's actually the framework for a very rich and fruitful culture and very productive as well. So, but moving forward in Ukraine, so the United States and Israel and the European Union manipulated a situation. And they basically got their anti-Soviet assets from the far radical right to create what looks increasingly like a failed state.
Let me ask you a little bit more about Islam and specifically in Europe, and if you believe that it's being used to create friction and cultural clash, because I've been of course questioning who has been behind the policies to accept this and try to find if there's other political reasons for why this is occurring. What do you think?
You know, the government of Turkey, of course, has been an ally of NATO and has dealt very closely with Germany and the European Union for many, many decades. And one of the agreements, of course, they had was to allow many Turks to move to Germany, other parts of Europe. And then, of course, in more recent decades, we've seen influx of populations from Lebanon. And then, of course, and Lebanese have a long tradition, of course, of living in unintrusive communities all over the world. They are mercantile trading culture going way back to the times of the Carthaginians, of course. And before, with Phoenicians.
Yeah.
And so that's not a problem. But what has happened with, of course, the U.S. wars in Iraq and Syria has in the last decade, has increased migration, has created failed states there. And so these people, you know, people have a right to live and they need to live somewhere. And Europe has, I think, cynically set up a system to receive these people. Then this creates, of course, a surplus of labor, which drives down wages and benefits companies. Many of these countries, Iraq and Syria, invested billions and billions in infrastructure, university systems, and in all the technical trades. So you have actually some very highly skilled, highly educated people coming who are willing to work for much less because they can also send money home and then return home if they still have one. And in general, they had a different culture where, whether Europeans want to hear it or not, people were used to working harder and longer hours and were willing to sacrifice more. But of course, without complicating things, the nature of gender relations in those countries made it more worthwhile for men to make those kinds of sacrifices.
Yeah.
And so it's a very complex situation which the European powers understand very well. And this has been used to divide and conquer in Europe, and has artificially created a social movement which, instead of targeting the very banks and corporations and, say, the policies of Brussels, which have allowed this, instead you have people on the street targeting other Muslims on the street when neither of those people are to blame for what's happening.
I agree, and I also think, and I've always tried to say this when this comes up here, because I've seen plenty of willing dupes in Europe as well that are seem to be happy to play along with this game. And I can preface that a little bit. I can just mention a couple of things of why I think this is the case. But what I'm talking about is, of course, the massive violent demonstrations that have taken place within Europe. And there's, of course, a rise in violence in a country like Sweden, for example. We've had a tremendous increase in the rape statistics, which is borderlining on the epidemic, and no one is talking about this. That people are refusing to look at this, and of course, as we know, when you put the lid on and turn the other way, things are just going to get worse and worse. But I think that what has happened is that the radicalization of Islam has been within Europe has been, yes, partially kind of induced and funded, and we should question, are there agents and operatives within these religious groups that are, you know, egging on the situation, trying to exacerbate it? That's very possible. But at the same time, I think when you're in a situation where you are a minority, let's say, when you feel that you don't have a connection to your roots or to your homeland, I think you're going to seek to you know, kind of cling on to that even harder. You're going to try to do something which makes you grounded to your traditions even more. So, for example, if we look at how you know, Egyptians, Islamic people in Egypt looked in the 50s. You could hardly distinguish them from a fashion sense from Americans in the 50s, very conservative looking, what have you. And then later you had a movement like the Muslim Brotherhood that started to radicalize even the way that Muslims looked. That they, there was an interesting Norwegian did a documentary about this, and he went down and he was a Muslim himself living in Norway. And he realized that this was done for kind of purposes of psychological warfare, that they started right. to apply that women needed to wear the burqa when this prior hadn't been such a claim, really. And even that the men were, you know, growing their beards long, etc. But it became like a, you know, kind of a warfare on a psychological level, if you see what I'm saying. Yeah. And I think that there's a lot of different reasons of different interplay here. But I guess my point being, after all of this been said and done, there's a lot of Muslims that seem to, you know, go along with these, with this agenda, exacerbating these conflicts. Why is that, do you think?
Absolutely. And it's like this. It's if you have, for example, there's a term for this in sociology. It's called cultural freezing. And it's already been observed, like, for example, that when you take people from one place and you move them to another, and they are a minority, and they are only there with like an extended family and a small community, they exaggerate those features that are different from the culture that they're living in. They tend to feel they miss their homes, as we talked about at the top of the hour. People tend to actually miss where they are from, and they remember them. They idealize those things, and they idealize them in their practices, and they idealize them in their way of life. I mean, people in Europe, people who are Muslim tend to have more of a radical view or a more hardline view of Islam than Muslims do in the Muslim world.
Exactly. Yeah.
But we cannot discount that this is not, there are, as I said, because of the phenomenon called cultural freezing, people tend to remember where they've come from differently and idealize it. And they also tend to think about it in the past and not how it's changed. Also, of course, because we understand already that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are Western intelligence projects, it is these very same Western European and American backed government intelligence organizations which are allowing the radical clerics to open up shop within even secular Muslim communities that might have been more secular even 10 years ago, and to allow them to foment a movement. And then many of these fighters that are in Syria today are actually coming from Europe, more so than one would expect, considering that they are in the Middle East. There are a surprisingly high number of those who are actually coming from Europe. And yeah. I don't think this is accidental.
No, of course not. It's kind of funny, but I think Sweden and Denmark had one of the highest numbers of where these fighters were coming from.
And why haven't their passports been revoked?
Well, exactly.
It's not like Sweden and Denmark don't have a security apparatus who monitor web forums, who can, you know, insert agents to look at what the clerics are saying inside the mosques, and can follow people's online activities. I mean, they do that all the time through Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, that's what they do. And yet they know exactly who these people are, and yet they are actually allowing and encouraging them to go because the project that they're doing favors what the EU and US want. And that's also what's happening in Ukraine. And so that describes, I think, fairly well on the pro-NATO side in Ukraine, in that civil war, what's going on. And if you'd like, I could also describe, which I think is more promising and points to the future, what's happening in the east of Ukraine on the so-called pro-Russian side.
Yeah, let's talk about that in a minute. I want to ask you another thing here about what you think is the goal. I want to make sure I understood that correct in terms of what Europe, let's say, let's call them Western forces for now. And I want people to understand we're not talking about the people of the West. We're talking about the elite of the West, obviously. But yeah. What do they seek to achieve? I've speculated for some time that they're seeking to really, you know, ramp up the conflict between the West and Islam, maybe even to at some stage go into a full blown war. There's of course speculations here that this would be beneficial to Israel, etc. But what do you think is the goal here of kind of exaggerating these conflicts that we see?
Yeah, I think that of course, they are trying to create failed states on Iran's door. And the thing is that this involves all spheres of life, economic development. They've looked at the numbers. They see that if they don't create failed states, that what has been called pan-Arabism, at least the economic side of pan-Arabism, is this eventuality. It is this inevitable thing that happens, right? If you have stability, stable populations, stable institutions, roads, lights that turn on at night, that ultimately you get broader economic regional integration and you get the rise of multipolarity. So they're trying to create failed states all over the world to prevent the rise of multipolarity and to preserve the post-Cold War window that lasted for 10 years. They want to create that little window and extend it indefinitely. So now within Europe, they also thing that people, I think, understand in your audience is that, as you said, European elites are not European people. And European elites aren't even necessarily considering themselves European in
That's
the
right.
sense that they care what happens to the people of Europe.
Yeah.
And they can move to Bali or Hong Kong or, wherever. They can move wherever they want. And they can, sell their multimillion dollar and move somewhere else. Doesn't matter. So they don't care if Europe just becomes a war zone. And if they can create, through a strategy of tension, ethnic strife between foreign or native-born Muslim population, whether they're Turkish or Arab, and between that and Europeans living in their homeland in Europe, if they can create that strife, then it sucks people's efforts away, and it distracts people and creates a failed state in Europe, and instead, whereas otherwise people, if they were say just Europeans or say the French in France and Germans in Germany and so forth, would actually unite along other common interests, middle-sized small business and workers would tend, without this program that they're putting in place, would tend to unite and really confront the power of the banks and the corporations and Brussels.
So this would also legitimize, I think, more control of sorts, more surveillance of European societies, militarization of the police. We've seen bombs go off in Malmö just a couple of weeks ago, southern Sweden, prior to that in Stockholm. And these are things that were unheard of, even 10 years ago, but it's really ramped up in that regard. So
yes,
basically,
it's a strategy of tension to further justify the increase of the surveillance state.
Yeah, and so if people are traditionally on the left, they if they're against imperialism, against war, globalization, the elite overall, the establishment, etc., what you're saying is then also they should be inherently against the false or the artificial displacement and multiculturalism that we see in Europe right now, correct?
Precisely.
Very good. I just want to have that clarified, because that's a point where I feel a lot of people on the left are falling completely short, and they don't see the long-term plan. They don't see how this is being used for other purposes. And I think they stare themselves blind on the aspect that if you don't accept it, then you're kind of a xenophobic hater of some kind that doesn't want to accept and help other human beings. But that's not the case, of course,
Right. We're the ones who want to see a world where people can help themselves and where people are inclined to help each other, because even though there are different groups of humanity, we are all human beings, and we all need to eat, and we all love our families, and we all love our friends, and there are these common threads that all make us human. But at the same time, in order for us to exist as humanity, we must embrace the things that have historically made us so interesting and have allowed us to survive. And when there isn't like some monoculture being enforced that's even good for people. And I'm not proposing that there should be one, but it happens to also be that the one that's being proposed is very destructive and allows for the rule of the banks and the corporations.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, there was a few points you wanted to talk about when it comes to what's going on in the east of Ukraine as well. Let's talk about that.
Right. So in looking at fourth generation warfare, and Ukraine is that the theory is called generational warfare theory. And one of the first people to look at this were from the U.S. and involved the works of a gentleman named William S. Lind. And basically, his theory is very good, and many, many have written on this subsequently. And it just looks at how the changes in information technology and in warfare technology are changing the paradigm of warfare, and have changed a lot of the doctrines of war and how war is waged. And we know that it's always involved media, but of course, with the rise of new media, it's also changed the nature of war, and these new methods of conducting war change the nature of media. And because the battle over hearts and minds moving forward is so important, that we are of course, it is not really a tenable economic model to have a paid army. And we know that in major wars that armies are conscripted, and that what under threat of you know, being indicted for failing to show up to fight, of course, is what soldiers historically have just basically always looked for reasons to flee the battlefield. And but in the new phase, starting say in the 1960s, we could, well, really starting with the partisan movement in Europe and what the communists were able to accomplish, and then moving forward to the 60s, looking at guerrilla movements in Southeast Asia, Latin America, following the model, of course, of the Greek Civil War and Spanish Civil War, where that people volunteered to fight for beliefs that they held very strongly. And this is kind of similar to religion, the role that religion had in the pre-modern era, and the ideology takes on a new substitute, in a sense, for religion. But also that we see in fourth generational war that there are non-state actors fighting against state actors, or, you know, mercenary armies fighting against NGO armies, and people fighting for different reasons. And then sometimes the soldiers meet and they switch sides, and a whole bunch of complex things really happen. But it's really characterized by the blurring of the lines between war and politics and combatants and civilians.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I've always wondered about ideology as a backdrop to a reason to fight, and not the least even defending yourself, as we've seen with, let's say, some of the American campaigns from the, I'd say, the Vietnam War and onwards, that since these Americans that go over there are not ideologically inclined, they're not defending their homeland, they're not as in touch with it as the defenders would be. I think that's one of the reasons as well that we've seen many failed military campaigns on that level. Yes. They just can't fight against this kind of mentality, right?
Yes, exactly. And people, you know, very, very far different from each other, like Oswald Mosley and Che Guevara and Stefan Bandera, and many, many different types of people who saw the world very differently from each other, all agreed that we had entered the phase of the political soldier. And the role of the political soldier changes even further between third generation warfare, where we saw the birth of the political soldier, and in fourth generation warfare, where the roles and duties of the political soldier transform and evolve. And so we see the use of new media, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and how people communicate peer-to-peer. People no longer are looking at the mainstream news and newspapers and television for their source of information. What people do when they look at those is they are still wrongly trying to look at what everyone else thinks. And that is something that people need to get past. But they kind of watch it in amazement just to kind of see what it is that the system is trying to say without really believing it. And what people are actually believing is a new form of truth. This is what I write about. It is a higher form of truth, and I put truth in scare quotes, that is derived through the simulacrum or the holographic reality, which is created when we believe or actually are receiving information from what we perceive to be peers in peer-to-peer media.
And this is something also they would... would want to utilize as a way of kind of, I think the powers understand also the innate suspicion, I guess, by people at this stage, by mainstream sources and media. They know that they're, you know, they've even done these studies in marketing. They realize, they know that people are, you know, they don't like when they watch commercials. They know that they're trying to manipulate people, etc. So I think the same level of psychology would apply to the news, for example. So we've seen, I think, kind of fabrications occur posing as, you know, just the guy on the street, etc. We've seen this now in a couple of, you know, campaigns, I would call them, or, you know, like that fake video of the child. I don't know if it was in Syria, whatever, but it came out there was a Danish filmmaker who was faking this child saving another girl, running away, etc. A lot of these kinds of scenarios can pop up where people are literally dragged into a situation where there would be in full support of warfare, which has been completely fabricated of a lie that was put up on YouTube. It's kind of ridiculous, isn't it?
It is, right. An interesting film I recommend is an American film with starring Dustin Hoffman called Wag the Dog.
Sure,
Which was about, of course, Yugoslavia, basically, and really showed how old media was used to manipulate. But of course, what's happening in Ukraine now is that one of the reasons, besides Russian military power, that the NATO is losing in Ukraine is that they cannot motivate people to fight for the Ukrainian side. People are being forced and conscripted. It's you know, all the time that they are being rounded up and captured, and they write about this when they're not captured, so we know it's true, that they're being threatened with imprisonment or their families losing pensions if they don't go fight. And they don't really want to be going to kill people in the east of Ukraine. And this is not to be confused. This is the regular army, not to be confused with the essentially Pravi sector brigades like Adar and Azov. So what has happened is that the Russians are winning this information war, and they are using a higher, more sophisticated form of fourth generational warfare through the use of new media, decentralization, creating a holograph or a simulacrum of decentralization, which the U.S. uses with Al-Qaeda in the Middle East. Russia has learned these, but they have applied them to a popular insurrection as opposed to a foreign war. So as you mentioned, people fighting on the defending side of their lands have an advantage. And if you include the latest technologies of fourth generational war, new media, and the use of holographic simulacrum combined with an indigenous uprising, this is a winning combination. And this explains a lot of the victories on the Novorossian side.
Very interesting. Of course, there's much more to discuss here. And I guess I wanted to, as a way of ending on something here, where do you think that the Russian-Ukrainian military situation will, where will this go? Because, I mean, we have a real possibility of, I think it was it the Senate now that voted 410 to 20 or something like that to actually start supporting the opposition here in the Ukraine with weapons. I mean, this could literally turn into a major conflict even quicker at this stage.
Yeah, things that the American Congress does are, you know, mostly symbolic and are meant to send messages. Of course, the U.S. has been funding this the whole time. You know, they've spent billions and billions and billions. On the record, they spent $5 or $6 billion just to overthrow the government back with the Euromaidan. But, you know, there's a big difference here. And this is why I think that there is some optimism. Despite the tragic loss of tens of thousands of people's lives and the hundreds of thousands of more who have been displaced, I don't mean to marginalize that. But there is, this cloud does have a silver lining, Henrik, and that is this, that the Russian objectives ultimately are simply regime change in Kiev of some kind. Now, that might involve some of the same people, including Poroshenko, who simply have to reverse the policy, but more likely not. But the Russian goal simply is regime change in Kiev. They need all of Ukraine to be like neutral / pro-Russian, like, you know, neutrally tending to Russia at least.
Yeah.
But the U.S. can only win this if they create a failed state in all of Ukraine and destabilize the Russian government and ultimately affect a regime change in Russia. So Russia does not need a regime change in Washington. They only need a regime change in Kiev, but the U.S. needs a regime change in Russia.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Good point. That is a good point. Now, is there anything else? I mean, we have much more to that we could talk about. We could go on, and we basically got to, I guess, the third way politics today. But of course, if you're interested in the future, we could have you back and actually talk more about fourth political theory, Alexander Dugin, etc. I know you, yes, you're closely related to some of this material as well. But right, let us know if there's anything you'd like to leave us with. And please give us if there's any of the websites or how people can you know, get a hold of you, or if there's any social network sites you want to give out or something like that.
Yes, I do. Because we were just talking about Ukraine, to get the best information on Ukraine, which is being written from the Russian perspective primarily, that's written in Russian that no one who doesn't read Russian can ever understand, the best website, which my colleague Christina Karlova is undertaking a tremendous task in translating this, is at Fort Rus. And if you Google Fort Rus, you will find a fantastically designed website which she updates 3 or 4 or 5 times a day with new articles. And she is also our staff translator for the Center for Syncretic Studies here in Belgrade. Again, Center for Syncretic Studies, we do more like reports. We're not a daily news or daily news analysis group. We are looking at sort of big questions, and we produce big reports, and we don't do journalism. And also for people who are looking at political activism and want an introduction to exploring ways of building political resistance, we recommend New Resistance and the website Open Revolt. One can Google either New Resistance or Open Revolt. It'll take you to the same place. And this is a tremendous resource. And we've opened up recently a chapter in Brazil. So we are expanding.
Well, very good. We'll have the websites that Joaquin mentioned here up on our website. So just click through easily from there, or of course, Google them for much more. Well, thank you so much, Joaquin. It was great having you today. And of course, finally connecting with you as well. Please keep up the good work, and it would be great to have you back again in the future.
Great. I'm glad to be here, Henrik.
Some interesting ideas today from Joaquin Flores. I think it's very important to see the common ground across the political spectrum in order to turn around the political system, focusing on the bigger issues first and then bicker about the details later. But of course, as we know, this is very, very difficult for people to do. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening today. We hope you have some new things to consider. Always a pleasure to have you with us. Of course, we also want to say thank you for being a member. We couldn't do this without you guys and gals, so a big thanks to you. We have much more coming. We'll be back on Monday again with Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki. Then we have Jay Dyer, Laird Scranton, the Swedish surveyor, Patrick Henningsen, Marion Van Court, John Lash, and later Dennis Fetcho, Jeff Gates, and Allison Weir, to name a few. Well, for now, we say take good care of yourself, your family, stay healthy, stay focused, and we'll speak more in just a few. Bye-bye.